he had to pretend that this was all interesting, which, if successfully done, could get him nominated for the next Academy Award ceremonies for Best Actor in a Supporting Role. For keeping awake during the most boring contest since the Iowa Grass Growing Championships, the winner is... He concentrated on not shifting in his seat, but that just made his ass tired, and these seats hadn't been designed to fit his ass. Maybe one of those skinny Chinese ones, but not that of a Chicago-raised professional who liked having a beer and a corned beef sandwich for lunch at least once a week and didn't work out enough. His ass required a broader and softer seat for comfort, but he didn't have one. He tried to find something interesting. He decided that Foreign Minister Shen had terrible skin, as though his face had once been on fire and a friend had tried to extinguish the flames with an ice pick. Gant tried to conjure up the image of that supposed event without smiling. Then came the fact that Shen was smoking so much, lighting his smokes from cheap paper matches instead of a proper lighter. Perhaps he was one of those people who set things down and forgot where they were, which would also explain why he used cheap, throwaway pens instead of something in keeping with his rank and status. So this important son of a bitch had suffered from terminal acne as a kid, and was a Butterfingers? It was something worthy of an inward smile as the minister droned on in passable English. That engendered a new thought. He had access to an earphone for simultaneous translation. Could he get one tuned to a local station? They had to have a radio station in Beijing that played music of some sort or other, didn't they? When Rutledge's turn came, it was almost as bad. The stated American position was as repetitive as the Chinese one, perhaps more reasonable but no less boring. Gant imagined that lawyers talking over a divorce settlement probably went through bullshit like this. Like diplomats, they were paid by the hour and not by the product. Diplomats and lawyers, what a pair, Gant thought. He was unable even to look at his watch. The American delegation had to present a united front of solid stone, Gant thought, to show the heathen Chinese that the forces of truth and beauty were firm in their resolve. Or something like that. He wondered if it would feel different negotiating with the British, for example, everyone speaking much the same language. But those negotiations were probably handled with phone calls or emails rather than this formalistic crap. Lunch came at the expected hour, about 10 minutes late because the Shen guy ran over, which was hardly unexpected. The American team all headed to the men's room, where no talking was done for fear of bugs. Then they went back outside, and Gant went to Rutledge. "This is how you earn your living?" the stock trader asked with no small degree of incredulity. "I try to. These talks are going pretty well," the Assistant Secretary of State observed. "What?" Gant inquired with total amazement. "Yeah, well, their foreign minister is doing the negotiating, so we're playing with their varsity," Rutledge explained. "That means that we'll be able to reach a real agreement instead of a lot of back and forth between lower-level people and the Politburo. The additional layer of people can really mess things up. There'll be some of that, of course. Shen will have to talk over his positions with them every evening, maybe even right now. He's nowhere to be seen. I wonder who he reports to exactly. We don't think he really has plenipotentiary powers that the rest of the big boys second-guess him a lot, like the Russians used to be. That's the problem with their system. Nobody really trusts anybody else." "You serious?" Telescope asked. "Oh, yeah. It's how their system works." "That's a clusterfuck," Gant observed. "Why do you think the Soviet Union went belly up?" Rutledge asked with amusement. "They never had their act together on any level because they fundamentally didn't know how properly to exercise the power they had. It was rather sad, really. But they're doing a lot better now." "But how are the talks going? Well?" If all they have to throw at us is Taiwan, their counter-arguments on trade won't be all that impressive. Taiwan's a settled issue, and they know it. We may have a mutual defense treaty with them in 10 or 11 months, and they probably know that. They have good intelligence sources in Taipei. How do we know that? Gant demanded. Because our friends in Taipei make sure they do. You want your adversaries to know a lot of things. It makes for better understandings, cuts down on mistakes and stuff. Rutledge paused. I wonder what's for lunch. Jesus, Gant thought. Then he thanked God that he was just here to offer economic backup for this diplomat. They were playing a game so different from anything he'd ever encountered before that he felt like a truck driver doing some day trading on his laptop at a highway phone booth. The newsies showed up for lunch so that they could get more B-roll tape of diplomats chatting amiably about such things as the weather and the food. The viewers would think they were handling matters of state, of course, when in fact at least half of the talks between diplomats at such affairs were limited to the problems of raising children or killing the crabgrass in your lawn. It was all in fact a kind of gamesmanship with few parallels in other forms of endeavor. Gant was only beginning to understand. He saw Barry Wise approach Rutledge without a microphone or camera in attendance. "So, how's it going, Mr. Secretary?" the reporter asked. "Pretty well. In fact, we had a fine opening session," Rutledge replied in Gant's earshot. It was a shame, Telescope decided, that the people couldn't see what really happened. It would be the funniest thing this side of Chris Rock. It made Laverne and Shirley look like King Lear in its lunacy, and the World Chess Championship look like a heavyweight championship fight in its torpor. But every field of human endeavor had its rules, and these were just different ones. "There's our friend," the cop observed, as the car pulled out. It was Suvorov/Konyev in his Mercedes C-Class. The license tag number checked, as did the face in the binoculars. Provolov had gotten the local varsity to handle this case, with even some help now from the Federal Security Service, formerly the second chief directorate of the former KGB. The professional spy chasers who'd made life in Moscow difficult for foreign intelligence operations. They remained superbly equipped, and though not so well funded as in the past, there was little to criticize in their training. The problem, of course, was that they knew all that themselves, and took on a degree of institutional arrogance that had gotten the noses of his homicide investigators severely out of joint. Despite all that, they were useful allies. There were a total of 7 vehicles to handle the surveillance. In America, the FBI would have arranged a helicopter as well, but Michael Riley wasn't here to make that condescending observation, somewhat to Provolov's relief. The man had become a friend, and a gifted mentor in the business of investigation. But enough was sometimes enough. There were trucks containing TV cameras to tape the business of the morning, and every automobile had 2 people in it so that driving wouldn't interfere with watching. They followed Suvorov/Konyev into central Moscow. Back at his apartment, another team had already defeated his lock and was inside his flat. What happened there was as graceful as any performance by the Bolshoi Ballet. Once inside, the investigative team stood still at first, scanning for telltales, left behind items as innocuous as a human hair stuck in place across a closet door to show if someone had opened it. Suvorov's KGB file was finally in Provolov's possession now, and he knew all the things the man had been trained in. It turned out that his training had been quite thorough, and Suvorov's grades had been, well, C-class most of the time, not outstanding enough to earn him the chance to operate in the field as an illegal officer on the home ground of the main enemy, meaning the United States, but good enough that he'd become a diplomatic intelligence specialist, mainly going over information brought in by others, but spending some time in the field, trying to recruit and run agents. Along the way, he'd established contact with various foreign diplomats, including 3 from China. Those 3 he'd used to gather low-level diplomatic information, mainly chit-chat-level stuff, but it was all regarded as useful. Suvorov's last field assignment had been from 1989 to 91 in the Soviet embassy in Beijing, where he'd again tried to gather diplomatic intelligence, and they saw with some success this time. The accomplishments had not been questioned at the time, Provorov saw, probably because he'd had some minor victories against the same country's diplomatic service while in Moscow. His file said that he could both speak and write Chinese, skills learned at the KGB Academy that had militated in favor of making him a China specialist. One of the problems with intelligence operations was that what looked suspicious was often innocuous, and what looked innocuous could well be suspicious. An intelligence officer was supposed to establish contact with foreign nationals, often foreign intelligence officers, and then the foreign spy could execute a maneuver that the Americans called a flip, turning an enemy into an asset. The KGB had done the same thing many times, and part of the price of doing such business was that it could happen to your own people. Not so much while you were not looking as when you were. 1989 to 91 had been the time of glasnost, the openness that had destroyed the Soviet Union as surely as smallpox had annihilated primitive tribesmen. At that time, KGB was having problems of its own, Provorov reminded himself. And what if the Chinese had recruited Suvorov? The Chinese economy had just been starting to grow back then, and so they'd had the money to toss around. Not as much as the Americans always seemed to have, but enough to entice a Soviet civil servant looking at the prospect of losing his job soon. But what had Suvorov been doing since then? He was now driving a Mercedes-Benz automobile, and those didn't appear in your mailbox. The truth was that they didn't know, and finding out would not be very easy. They knew that neither Klementy Ivanich Suvorov nor Ivan Yuryevich Konev had paid his income taxes, but that merely put him at the same level as most Russian citizens, who didn't want to be bothered with such irrelevancies. And again they hadn't wanted to question his neighbors. Those names were now being checked to see if any were former KGB, and perhaps, therefore, allies of their suspect. No, they didn't want to alert him in any way. The apartment looked clean, in the police sense. With that, they began looking around. The bed was mussed up. Suvorov / Konev was a man, and therefore not terribly neat. The contents of the apartment were, however, expensive, much of them of foreign manufacture. West German appliances, a common affectation of the Russian well-to-do. The searchers wore latex surgical gloves as they opened the refrigerator door. Refrigerator freezers are well-regarded hiding places for a visual examination. Nothing obvious. Then dresser drawers. The problem was that their time was limited and any residents just had too many places to hide things, whether rolled up in a pair of socks or inside the toilet paper tube. They didn't really expect to find much, but making the effort was de rigueur. It was harder to explain to one's superiors why one didn't do it than it was to send the search team in to waste their expensively trained time. Elsewhere, people were tapping the apartment's phone. They'd thought about installing some pinhole lens cameras. These were so easy to hide that only a paranoid genius was likely to find them. But putting them in took time. The hard part was running the wires to the central monitoring station, and time was an asset they didn't have. As it was, their leader had a cell phone in his shirt pocket, waiting for it to vibrate with the word that their quarry was driving back home, in which case they'd tidy up and leave in a hurry. He was 12 kilometers away. Behind him, the trail cars were switching in and out of visual coverage as deftly as the Russian national football team advancing the soccer ball into tight game opposition. Provorov was in the command vehicle, watching and listening as the KGB/FSS team leader used a radio and a map to guide his people in and out. The vehicles were all dirty, middle-aged, nondescript types, that could be owned by the Moscow city government or gypsy cab operators, expected to dart around, concealing themselves among the numerous twins they all had. In most cases, the second vehicle occupant was in the back seat, not the front, to simulate a taxi's passenger. And they even had cell phones to complete the disguise, which allowed them to communicate with their base station without looking suspicious. That, the FSS leader remarked to the cop, was one advantage of new technology. Then came the call that the subject had pulled over, stopped, and parked his car. The two surveillance vehicles in visual contact continued past, allowing new ones to close in and stop. "He's getting up," a Federal Security Service major reported. "I'm getting out to follow on foot." The major was young for his rank, usually a sign of a precocious and promising young officer on the way up. And so it was in this case. He was also handsome with his 28 years, and dressed in expensive clothing like one of the new crop of Muscovite business entrepreneurs. He was talking into his phone in a highly animated fashion, the very opposite of what someone conducting a surveillance would do. That enabled him to get within 30 meters of the subject, and to watch his every move with hawk's eyes. Those eyes were needed to catch the most elegant of maneuvers. Suvorov/Konyev sat on a bench, his right hand already in his overcoat pocket, while his left fiddled with the morning paper he'd brought out from the car. And that is what tipped the FSS major that he was up to no good. A newspaper was the main disguise used by a spy, something to cover the actions of the working hand, just as a stage magician kept one hand ostentatiously busy while the other performed the actual illusion. And so it was here. So beautifully done that had he been an untrained man, he would never have caught it. The major took a seat on another bench and dialed up another false number on his cell phone and started talking to a fictitious business associate, then watched his surveillance subject stand and walk with studied casualness back to his parked Mercedes. Major Yefremov called a real number when his subject was 100 meters away.
"This is Pavel Georgievich. I am staying here to see what he left behind," he told his base station.
He crossed his legs and lit a cigarette, watching the figure get back into his car and drive off. When he was well out of sight, Yefremov walked over to the other bench and reached under. Oh, yes. A magnetic holder. Suvorov had been using this one for some time. He'd glued a metal plate to the bottom of the green-painted wood, and to this he could affix a magnetic holder. About 1 centimeter in thickness, his hand told him. Their subject was a player after all. He'd just executed a dead drop. On hearing it, Provolov experienced the thrill of seeing a crime committed before his very eyes. Now they had their man committing a crime against the state. Now he was theirs. Now they could arrest him at any time. But they wouldn't, of course. The operations commander next to him ordered Yefremov to retrieve the container for examination. That would be done very speedily, because the container would have to be returned. They only had half of the spy team. The other half would come to pick it up. It was the computer. It had to be. On turning it on, they found a maze of folders, but one of them, they quickly saw, had encrypted contents. The encryption program was one they hadn't come across before. It was American, and its name was written down. They could do no more now. They lacked the proper disks to copy the covert file. That they could fix, and they could also copy the encryption program. Next, they'd have to plant a bugging device on the keyboard. In that way, they could use Suvorov's own password code to crack the encrypted file. With that decision made, the burglary team left the premises. The next part was virtually preordained. They followed the Mercedes using the same multi-car drill, but the break came when a dump truck, still the dominant form of life on the Moscow streets, was closest. The subject parked the German sedan and jumped out, took just enough time to affix a strip of paper taped to a lamppost, and hopped back into his car. He didn't even bother to look around, as though he'd only done something routine. But he hadn't. He'd just posted a flag, a notice to someone unknown that the dead drop had something in it. That someone would walk or drive past and see the tape and know where to go. So they had to examine the capsule quickly and replace it, lest they warn the enemy spy that their little operation had been compromised. No, you didn't do that until you had to, because things like this were like an unraveling sweater on a pretty woman. You didn't stop pulling the yarn until the tits were exposed, the FSS commander told Provolov. This concludes the reading of The Bear and the Dragon by Tom Clancy, Part 1.